Imagine you are walking home, right? And you've just had this brutal, exhausting day of physical labor. You are tired, your bones are aching, and you just want to see your family.
Oh, yeah. You're just completely drained.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, an armed soldier from an occupying military force just steps right in front of you. He drops this 80-pound pack of gear at your feet, and he orders you to carry it for a mile.
And legally, you have absolutely no choice.
Right. You have no choice. You hate this soldier. I mean, he represents everything oppressive in your entire world. But, and here's the crazy part. What if the secret to completely stripping that soldier of his power over you wasn't fighting back?
Which is what anyone would want to do.
Yeah, obviously. But what if the secret was actually smiling, picking up that ridiculously heavy pack and offering to carry it twice as far?
I mean, it sounds utterly absurd.
It really does.
On paper, responding to oppression with, you know, voluntary extra submission, it looks completely unrealistic. It looks like a guaranteed recipe for just getting trampled on by the world.
Yeah, like you're just asking for it.
Exactly. But that inherent absurdity is exactly what makes the concepts we are exploring today so compelling.
Welcome, loving family members. Today we are exploring a fascinating sermon based on the Gospel of Matthew, specifically chapter 5, verses 38 through 42. And let's be honest, reading through the requirements laid out in the sermon, they feel entirely disconnected from the basic rules of human survival.
They absolutely do, because this sermon introduces a standard that is not meant to be normal. It outlines what it calls a heavenly standard of living. But the catch is, it demands that this standard be applied right here, in the messiness and the friction of our everyday lives.
Okay, let's unpack this. The mission for our exploration today is to really uncover why this sermon calls for such a seemingly irrational, just abnormal way of living. And more importantly, we want to see how adopting this countercultural mindset might actually be the ultimate secret to breaking the world's endless cycles of negativity.
Right, because to understand this radical new way of living, we first have to understand the old rules it was replacing. You cannot appreciate the paradigm shift without knowing the original baseline.
Right, the status quo.
Exactly. So the sermon starts by referencing an ancient legal concept. You've probably heard it. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth.
Oh, definitely. Everyone knows that one.
Yeah. And when modern audiences hear that phrase, they almost universally interpret it as a justification for revenge. The assumption is that it means if you hurt me, well, I have the moral and legal right to hurt you back just as hard.
Yeah, it sounds like this ancient endorsement of vendettas. Like, yeah. You take my stuff, I take yours.
It really does sound like that. But historically and logically, it functioned as the exact opposite.
Wait, really?
Yeah. That Old Testament law was not an instruction to take revenge. It was actually a strict legal boundary designed to contain human nature. I mean, think about how human instinct actually operates in the real world.
It's unpredictably.
Right. If someone accidentally damages your property or they insult you, the instinctual drive is rarely satisfied with just equal compensation. The emotional drive for retaliation is basically limitless.
Oh, absolutely. If you scratch my car, I want to total yours.
Exactly. If you take my eye, I don't just want your eye. I want your eye, your arm, your livelihood, and, you know, probably your reputation destroyed, too.
I see. So it's kind of like a referee stepping into a highly chaotic, emotional street fight.
That's a great way to look at it.
Like, the referee isn't there to encourage the fighters to hurt each other more. They're stepping in to enforce strict proportional rules so the fighters don't just completely destroy one another in a blind rage. The rule limits the damage to a 1-to-1 ratio instead of like a 1-to-10 escalation.
That analogy captures the mechanics perfectly. The law was essentially a fence. But the problem with laws, even really good ones, is that they only regulate behavior, right? They do not change the human heart.
Yeah, you might fall on the rule, but you're still furious on the inside.
Precisely. There is always a loophole, a gap, where resentment just continues to simmer. This sermon, though, presents a completely different approach. It doesn't just want to limit the scale of revenge. It asks the audience to abandon the instinct for it entirely.
Which brings us to perhaps the most famous instruction in the entire sermon. It says, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also.
Right, the classic turn the other cheek.
Yeah, most people know the phrase, but the sermon provides some really crucial historical context that fundamentally changes how we should read this moment.
What's fascinating here is the deliberate, specific mention of the right cheek. Because in the Jewish society of that era, the vast majority of people were right-handed.
Okay, so just like today.
Yeah, but back then, using the left hand for public interaction was heavily stigmatized. So picture the physical mechanics for a second. If a right-handed person is facing you and they want to strike your right cheek, how do they physically do it?
Let me think. If I punch straight out with my right hand, I'd hit their left cheek.
Exactly. You cannot throw a straight punch or use an open palm to hit the right cheek that would hit the left. To strike your right cheek with their right hand, they have to physically cross their arm all the way over their body.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they have to use the back of their hand.
A backhanded slap?
Yes.
Wow, which carries a totally different energy than just a punch and a bar brawl.
Oh, completely. Right. It changes the entire dynamic of the confrontation. In that culture, a backhanded slap was not primarily about causing physical injury. It wasn't about starting a fight to the death.
What was it about then?
It was a calculated theatrical act of profound public contempt. It was a gesture specifically meant to humiliate you, to establish absolute superiority, and to strip away your dignity right in front of your peers. It was essentially the ultimate status insult.
Okay, I have to push back on this, though.
Sure, go ahead.
Because if someone publicly humiliates you like that, whether it's a literal physical insult in the ancient world or, you know, a metaphorically backhanded comment at your modern workplace, human instinct screams that you must defend your honor.
It's a very powerful instinct, yes.
Right. If you just stand there and physically offer them the other cheek, give them a free shot at whatever dignity you have left, you are basically advertising that you're a target. Doesn't that just turn you into a doormat? I mean, it feels like you are endorsing your own victimization.
It is entirely natural to feel that way. I mean, the immediate biological response to a status threat is a massive adrenaline spike. Your body demands that you reassert your dominance. But the sermon frames turning the other cheek as the exact opposite of weakness.
How so?
Well, consider the immense internal power and just ironclad self-control it takes to suppress that burning primal instinct.
It take a lot.
Right. To intentionally absorb a public humiliation, look the aggressor right in the eye, and actively refuse to strike back requires an incredible display of strength. You are not a doormat. You are an immovable object.
Okay, so the restraint itself is the power move. I get that.
Mm-hmm.
But how does that solve the underlying conflict?
It addresses the mechanics of conflict itself. Think of revenge as essentially an escalating bidding war where the currency is suffering.
Okay, I insult you. You insult me worse.
I retaliate physically, you escalate with weapons, and the cycle never, ever stops. The sermon suggests that yielding your right to retaliate is literally the only action that jams the gears of that machine.
Because you just stop playing the game.
Exactly. By turning the other cheek, you are refusing to place a bid. You bankrupt the whole transaction right then and there. You step off the cycle of victim and aggressor, leaving the ultimate judgment to God.
Because according to the theology presented in the sermon, God is the final judge. So we don't have to appoint ourselves as the executioner in that heated moment.
Right. And the sermon points to Jesus as the ultimate embodiment of this principle. The text notes how, while hanging on the cross, he actively forgave the very people who were mocking and executing him.
Talk about an extreme example.
He absorbed the absolute maximum amount of humiliation without returning hostility. And this concept of absorbing hostility without retaliation is so potent that the sermon notes it profoundly altered the worldview of the author Leo Tolstoy, leading him to actually advocate for complete nonviolent pacifism.
Wow. That is a staggering amount of emotional restraint.
Yeah.
But surrendering our ego and our pride in the face of an insult is still an internal battle. And the sermon does not stop at internal pride. It moves aggressively into our physical security next.
It certainly does. The demands move from defending your dignity to defending your actual tangible property.
Yes. The sermon brings up this scenario where someone sues you for your tunic, which, as I understand it, is your inner garment, basically like a shirt.
Correct.
And the instructions that you're supposed to give them your cloak as well, your outer garment.
The historical context here is absolutely vital for understanding the true weight of this demand. In the ancient Near East, textile production was incredibly labor intensive.
Right. You didn't just order cheap clothes online.
Yeah.
No, not at all. A cloak was serious capital. It was a critical multi-purpose survival tool. During the day, it protected you from the harsh elements. And at night, when the desert temperatures plummeted, your cloak was your blanket. For a poor person, it was effectively their bed.
So it was essential for staying alive.
Exactly. In fact, the legal codes of the time even stipulated that if you took a poor person's cloak as collateral for a loan, you had to return it by sunset, or they could literally freeze to death overnight.
So what does this all mean? Giving away your cloak isn't just some gesture of casual charity. This isn't tossing spare change into a tip jar because you have a little extra in your pocket.
Not at all.
This defies basic economic self-preservation. This is like someone demanding to borrow your winter coat in the middle of a blizzard and you handing them the keys to your car so they can sleep in it with the heater running. From a pure survival standpoint, choosing to give away your cloak is effectively choosing hypothermia. So what logic is the sermon actually operating on here?
Well, it is entirely illogical if you are operating on the world standard logic, which is strict cost-benefit analysis.
Boy, the spreadsheet logic.
Yeah. Human beings are conditioned to constantly calculate. We're always asking, what do I need to keep myself safe? What is my fair share? What happens to me if I lose this?
Self-preservation.
Exactly. But the sermon introduces a completely different heavenly logic. It pivots entirely away from self-preservation, proposing this radical idea that the person demanding your shirt might actually just need your coat more than you do.
Wow. So it shifts the focus from fiercely guarding what is legally yours to an almost reckless level of care for the person standing in front of you.
That's beautifully put. You are abandoning the mathematics of scarcity. You are giving the person not just what they demand in a lawsuit, but what they actually need to survive, even when it poses a massive, dangerous cost to your own comfort and security.
Okay, so we have looked at giving up our pride when we are insulted and giving up our essential possessions when we are sued. Now, the sermon transitions to an area that might be honestly, even more difficult for modern audiences to digest.
Oh, I know where you're going.
Yeah, giving up our time, our physical energy, and our autonomy.
This is where we encounter the famous concept of going the extra mile.
Right. The text instructs, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. And this takes us right back to that scenario we opened the show with.
It does. And to fully grasp how genuinely shocking this was to the original audience, we have to examine Roman requisition laws, specifically this practice called angaria.
Angaria, okay.
At the time, Judea was a province under Roman military occupation, and Roman soldiers had the legal right to force any civilian they encountered to just drop whatever they were doing and carry the soldiers' heavy gear for 1 Roman mile, which is roughly 1,000 paces.
I mean, think about that. You were an occupied people. That soldier represents the empire that taxes you, brutalizes your community, and disrespects your customs.
He's the face of your oppression.
Exactly. Carrying that pack is an active public humiliation. Every step you take under the weight of that gear is a reminder that you are not free.
And, crucially, you legally have no choice. Refusal could mean severe physical punishment or even death. It was a deeply hated law, just this constant looming threat of powerlessness.
And here is where I struggle deeply with the sermon's instruction. Let's bring this to a relatable modern feeling, even outside of, you know, a military occupation.
Sure.
I struggle to do the things I'm legally or contractually forced to do with a good attitude. I mean, we live in an era where protecting your boundaries is paramount. Taking miserable, humiliating, forced labor and then voluntarily doubling it.
It sounds crazy.
It sounds like you were just enabling your oppressor. It feels like you were giving them permission to exploit you further.
It is so easy to view it as enabling, but there is an immense psychological brilliance hidden in the mechanism of that second mile. Let's break down the power dynamics.
Okay, I'm listening.
For that first mile, the legally required 1,000 paces, you are a victim. You are acting under the threat of state violence. The soldier holds all the power, and you are essentially a slave to his command.
Yeah, your body is moving, but you are boiling with resentment because your agency has been totally stolen.
But imagine the exact moment you reach the end of that required mile. The soldier expects you to drop the pack, glare at him, and walk away.
Right, doing the bare minimum.
Instead, you willingly adjust the straps, look at him, and say, I will carry it another mile for you. In that split second, the entire power dynamic flips upside down.
Oh, wow.
The next mile is not forced oppression. The soldier cannot force you to do something you are actively volunteering to do. The moment you choose to go further than the law requires, you strip the oppressor of their leverage.
Because it's your choice now.
Exactly. You are no longer a victim. You are a voluntary agent of grace. You are in complete control of the situation.
You reclaim your agency by outgiving the demand. That is a brilliant psychological pivot.
And the sermon's application of this goes far beyond ancient Rome. I mean, think about our modern workplaces. Often, we operate purely on what we could call money logic.
All I know, not need logic.
Right. We calculate exactly what our salary covers, we read our job description, and we execute precisely that amount of work, not a single email more. We guard our boundaries fiercely.
We just carry the metaphorical pack for the 1 mile we are paid for, and honestly, we resent every step.
And when we operate strictly within that transactional mindset, we remain trapped by the feeling of obligation. Work feels like a forced march. But the sermon suggests that when we shift our perspective, when our actions are driven by a spirit of voluntary generosity rather than just contractual obligation, the nature of the work completely changes.
It stops being a burden.
Yes, it becomes a joyful offering. Bringing a spirit of willingness and extra care to what we do fundamentally alters the quality of our own lives. We stop being victims of our circumstances or our employers and become active creators of a different kind of environment.
That paradigm shift is so powerful. But looking at all these examples together, there is a very obvious glaring flaw here.
Uh-oh, what is it?
Well, if you actually live this way, if you give away your pride to the person who insults you, and you hand over your vital winter clothes to the person who sues you, and freely volunteer your limited time and energy to the people who demand it, won't you just end up completely destroyed?
The math certainly seems to point that way.
Yeah. You will be exhausted, freezing, and utterly depleted. If you only have a finite amount of resources, constantly giving them away means you inevitably hit zero.
That is the inescapable conclusion of the world's mathematics. Under the logic of scarcity, radical generosity is basically a form of slow suicide.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The sermon anticipates this exact fear. It addresses the mechanics of how a person could possibly sustain this kind of reckless giving. And the answer it provides is rooted entirely in how it defines the character of God.
Exactly. The underlying foundation that makes these commands survivable is the concept of God's economy. The sermon posits that God's economy is not based on finite resources and scarcity. It operates on infinite, overflowing abundance.
It's totally different math.
Yeah, and to build this argument, the text points to narratives like the miracle at the wedding at Cana and the feeding of the thousands with the loaves and fishes.
Let's examine those narratives. At the wedding in Cana, the hosts run out of wine, which in that culture wasn't just a minor inconvenience, it was a devastating social and financial disgrace.
It would ruin a family's reputation for generations.
Right. And according to the text, Jesus doesn't just synthesize enough mediocre wine to help them scrape by. He creates an overwhelming, excessive abundance of the absolute finest vintage.
Way more than they could ever drink.
Exactly. And similarly, with the loaves and fishes, he takes a tiny, totally inadequate lunch, feeds a massive crowd, and they end up collecting baskets and baskets of leftovers. There's more at the end than there was at the beginning.
The sermon uses these narratives to illustrate a core theological mechanism. The reason a person can afford to abandon their stinginess, the reason they can safely let go of their fierce, white-knuckled grip on their time, their pride, and their possessions, is because they believe they are backed by the ultimate infinite supplier.
It is like, think of life as a bakery.
Okay, a bakery.
You don't need to fiercely protect your single slice of pie or, fight everyone off to guard your one little crumb. If you know for an absolute fact that the baker has an infinite kitchen, endless ingredients, and is constantly baking fresh pies just for you.
That is exactly how the sermon frames it. You are safe to give because your supply chain is not dependent on the finite zero-sum game of the world. It is tethered to an infinite God.
Wow.
The text argues that individuals are called to be radically, boundlessly generous because Christ modeled that boundless generosity toward humanity first. He poured out his life holding nothing back. When a person realizes they are the recipient of that level of lavish, unearned grace, the instinct to hoard just vanishes.
It evaporates.
Yeah. Giving away a cloak or carrying a pack an extra mile simply doesn't register as a threat to your survival anymore.
Because the math of scarcity no longer applies to you. So, returning to the mission we said at the beginning of our conversation, the core message of this sermon isn't that this abnormal way of living is about being strange just for the sake of being quirky or contrarian.
Yeah, not at all.
It is about deliberately introducing a profound difference into the human ecosystem. We live in a world that is inherently transactional, it's defensive, and it's obsessed with self-preservation. When someone steps into that environment and operates on a completely alien logic, a logic of radical grace, suppressed ego, and infinite generosity, that difference becomes a beacon.
It really does.
It disrupts the darkness.
Yeah.
It's literally impossible to ignore.
This raises an important question about the end goal. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the objective of all these demanding commands, turning the cheek, handing over the cloak, walking the extra mile, is not just to achieve an abstract state of moral perfection.
It's not a scorecard.
Exactly. The sermon isn't offering a checklist for earning a gold star. The goal is to actively resemble Christ. It is about mirroring that specific character to a world that desperately needs to see it in action. Trusting that God will fill our deficits is the mechanism that allows us to safely take losses in the eyes of the world.
Because we have that infinite backing.
Right. We can afford to lose a petty argument, lose a piece of property, or lose our free time because we operate under the belief that God will restore and sustain us.
It is a beautifully challenging vision of how human interactions could actually function. And to all our loving family members joining us today, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you navigate your week.
It's a great question to ask yourself.
Since our human instinct is so deeply wired to aggressively protect our pride, our property, and our precious time in this constant bidding war of suffering, what is one specific area in your life right now where choosing to purposefully lose might actually be the most powerful way to reclaim your agency and win? Take that thought with you into the days ahead.